Welcome to the court. We have two cases today. The first one is United States v. Valencia. Captain Norton, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Commander Cole, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well then, please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Captain Colin Norton, and I represent Lance Corporal Alvin Valencia in this case. I respectfully request 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
To trigger factual sufficiency review, appellant must make an allegation that at least one required element of a charged offense was not met beyond a reasonable doubt. Anything more creates a barrier depriving appellants of a unique safeguard in the military justice system. So, to trigger, the appellant must raise an assignment of error and then state a specific element which was not raised beyond a reasonable doubt. The triggering mechanism has then been met, and the CCAs are then to proceed to analysis under Part 2 of the statute. This is supported by the plain language, the structure of the statute, and the legislative history. Regarding the statute
Captain Norton, may I turn your attention to page 6 and 7 of your reply brief? In there, you refer repeatedly to CCAs viewing the evidence in a neutral light. For example, you write, when viewing the evidence in a neutral light, it is entirely possible the lower court could find that the government failed to prove disrespect beyond a reasonable doubt. I'm just wondering, where does that term, neutral light, come from? And what are you seeking to convey there when you're talking about the CCAs viewing the evidence in a neutral light?
Your Honor, I'm referring to the de novo review or the sliding scale de novo review that is occurring under Part 2 of the analysis.
So how does that mesh with the requirement under Article 66 that the lower court has to give appropriate deference to the fact finder?
Your Honor, that goes to Part 2 and is not part of the triggering mechanism. So under Part 1—
So you're just focusing on the triggering mechanism?
Yes, Your Honor.
When you're referring to neutral light?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, are you getting that from anywhere, or is that a term of art that you've developed?
I'm also getting it from the de novo review or sliding scale de novo review that factual sufficiency provides. So if this is in contrast to a legal sufficiency review, where the evidence is viewed in the light most favorable to the government and only some evidence needs to be shown, a factual sufficiency review will then show that a de novo review where the CCAs are to take the evidence and then provide the appropriate weighting under Part 2 of the statute. From there, they go to the findings, and that is how the statute is set up. The statute is set up as Part 1 is a triggering mechanism. Once that triggering mechanism is hit, the analysis is to occur under Part 2. Then under Part 3 is the findings. So it is logical that the CCAs are to start with Part 1. Once that triggering mechanism was met by the appellant raising the assignment of error for factual sufficiency for an element or elements that the appellant does not believe was met beyond a reasonable doubt, and then is proceeded to Part 2. And in Part 2 is the de novo review of the evidence, pursuant to Congress's instruction on how that evidence is to be reviewed.
Counsel, going back to the Part 1, what would be the minimum required for getting triggering this? Would it be possible to simply say sexual assault without consent involves two elements, sexual act without consent? The evidence was not factually sufficient for either of these elements, period. Is that enough?
Likely, Your Honor, that would likely be enough to trigger.
Well, doesn't that just negate the whole trigger thing? Because every single case would then, which appellate defense counsel wouldn't put that in their brief if all you could say is these are the elements, the evidence wasn't factually sufficient for either one of them, and then we're back to the old system where there was no trigger.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that appellate counsel would have a duty to raise only those assignments of error that they do believe is not frivolous. But if they believe an element, a single element, has not been met beyond a reasonable doubt due to a weighing of the evidence, then they proceed to the analysis under Part 2, believe this would limit and create the efficiency and effectiveness that the legislative history indicates was the purpose of this change.
What do the words specific showing of a deficiency mean then in your interpretation? Like, where, if that's all they had to do, say the crime has five elements, we don't think they met element four. What is the specific showing of a deficiency that would separate this from just a request for factual sufficiency review?
Is to, Your Honor, is to identify that issue of the element that they do not believe was met beyond a reasonable doubt. And that is, for purposes of showing can also mean to display or to identify. And if you're identifying a specific element that was deficient, you are able to then trigger. The issue is, if you are importing more analysis into that than is required, it's creating a standard that becomes unworkable. You have a standard that becomes a moving target, where what is enough to trigger? You insert analysis, one, that's not present in the statute, two, that becomes unworkable. You have appellants and the government that are arguing over whether the triggering mechanism is ever met, to then maybe make it to the next section of whether it is met beyond a reasonable doubt. It creates confusion and is more than is needed. This should be a ticket to entry. It should not be a barrier. Any barrier is a hindering on that unique safeguard this court has pointed to.
What would be so difficult about requiring the appellant to say, we think this element wasn't satisfied because? Right, and just have some reasonable because.
So, Your Honor, to the extent that that is needed, the simple existence of an analysis or discussion section should all that should be required if the court believes that that is needed. But once you start digging into the facts of the case, you're now conducting analysis. And
well,
that
just,
is
just
present.
Requiring, right? That's two separate questions, right? One is, how much do we make the appellant put in their request for factual sufficiency review? That's one question. And then what the CCA does with that request is a slightly different question. But would it be so difficult? Like in this case, do you think if the requirement was the appellant must say, we think this element wasn't satisfied under factual sufficiency review because reason, and that's all they have to do, would that have been satisfied in this case?
Your Honor, it would have been satisfied later in the analysis, but that's the problem, is the CCA started then digging into the analysis. They started requiring a major conflict of evidence.
Well, just before we get to the what the CCA did, like, could you look in their brief and satisfy, I hope you think they can, that they said they gave a because. They identified an element that wasn't satisfied, and then they said why they thought it wasn't satisfied. Did they do at least that much?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so then, if that's all the trigger required, it would have been triggered. And then there's a question of what does the CCA do? Is there any ability or authority of the CCA to rebut or reject that because at this stage, or is that a separate part of the analysis? Is that what you're arguing?
Yes, Your Honor. So the simple existence of that because, that how or why, regardless of what is stated, should be enough to trigger the analysis. So it should just be a prima facie showing. Anything more is starting to put that barrier up, is allowing the court to not allow that unique safeguard that this court is pointing to, that military justice accused enjoy.
Counsel?
Yes, sir.
I believe the government had a slightly different view of the meaning of showing. They cited a dictionary definition that essentially had two elements. It was evidence and argument. So the showing would go beyond a request. It would be you'd request, and then you had to have an argument based on evidence. And so merely, I would assume that merely saying the evidence was factually insufficient to prove this element would not be enough. You would have to say this was the evidence and it was insufficient because, or this evidence was missing and therefore it was insufficient. I mean, do you oppose this definition that they give, that a showing has to consist of these two elements?
Your Honor, I would oppose to the extent that it creates a more confusing standard to trigger this factual sufficiency review.
How would you distinguish? I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Please finish your sentence.
Your Honor, I was going to go into the purpose of the legislative history, that the purpose was for efficiency and effectiveness. When you're adding litigation into the triggering mechanism, this becomes more inefficient rather than efficient.
But counsel, I'm sorry, you had a follow-up.
Can I just ask one question?
Sure.
Could you distinguish a showing from a request? Because you have to have a request and a specific showing. And if a showing is the same thing as a request, then I think we have a problem with interpreting the statute.
Your Honor, show it can also mean to display. So they have to indicate with specificity the element which the appellant does not believe is met beyond a reasonable doubt.
And that goes beyond a request?
Yes, Your Honor, because a request can be more general. Here, so we would agree that a general disagreement with the overall verdict would be insufficient to trigger factual sufficiency review. Here, the appellant has to name the specific element that is not met beyond a reasonable doubt. And this creates efficiency. I mean, in this case, Article 91 is six elements. There is only one that was challenged. The CCAs can now essentially ignore the five other elements for factual sufficiency review. This creates more efficiency, which is the purpose of the statute's change.
Counsel, I want to go back to Judge Hardy's question, because he asked the question of what would be so difficult with the because, meaning using your construct, counsel would identify the specific element, and then, as he said, this element has not been met because, and it could just be a factual recitation, not a bunch of analysis. And so how does that then differ than what Judge Maggs was asking? I thought you had agreed that the because was okay.
Your Honor, my first course of action would be that the only thing that needs to be established or raised by the appellant is the dispute on one or more elements. But if the court is more willing to go with the course of action two, the simple presence of analysis or a discussion section would be enough to trigger. Okay. So the prima facie showing or analysis, without digging into the facts of that analysis, because once you start digging into the facts of the analysis, you're now into part two of the statute. You've already met the triggering mechanism. And that's part of the issue with the CCA's opinion, is they skip over the triggering mechanism, start digging into the facts and the argument, and then go back to the triggering mechanism to see if it's met to begin with. That's inefficient. It's not effective. And what results is a moving target for appellants to raise a factual sufficiency issue. Appellants, this should be easy for appellants. It should be so easy that the appellant themselves should be able to raise it if they're going per se or through a gras de fond. Without doing so is depriving them of this unique safeguard.
So, Captain Norton, in terms of, let's say we went, as you described it, the second course of action, from your perspective then, if the accused cites a farcical reason, that still triggers. The farcical nature needs to be addressed by the CCA at step two.
Yes, Your Honor. Because that is analysis of the facts of the case. And this is a de novo or sliding scale de novo based on the analysis section of part two of the statute, which Congress intended. There is no analysis section in part one for the triggering mechanism. The part two is where the analysis occurs and how the analysis is to occur.
So, counsel, I'm sorry, Chief, were you finished?
No, go ahead.
Oh, okay. With that then, based upon the Chief Judge's question, it sounds like an appellant would always trigger, that even if it was farcical, that just making the assertion would trigger the analysis under your argument?
Yes, Your Honor. But if this is being raised by counsel, that we have a duty to the courts to not bring frivolous issues in front of the CCAs or this court. But the appellant shouldn't be deprived of their rights under United States or gras de fond.
Okay. And you were about to move into legislative history, because then my next question is, well, then how does that square with clear congressional action to kind of create this funnel, to no longer have absolute factual sufficiency review required for every case? If merely stating there's a problem and identifying the element is sufficient, how does that then address what is clear congressional intent reflected in the text, that they want to limit the number of factual sufficiency reviews by the CCAs?
Your Honor, I believe this would still limit the factual sufficiency review because it needs to be raised by the appellant. Not every case is going to result in a factually sufficient review. And at a minimum, if only one of the elements, as was in this case, is being challenged, five of the elements can then be ignored by the CCA once the triggering mechanism is hit. That becomes efficient. For example, one of the elements is whether the appellant knew that he was speaking to an NCO. That wasn't raised, so that doesn't need to be addressed by the court. Previously, every case, the court had to review for factual sufficiency. Congress believed that that was too much, whether it was raised or not. Here, a specific element must be addressed. This is putting a spotlight on which element and which facts the appellant believes was not met beyond a reasonable doubt. And that was met in this case.
Counsel, before your time runs out, are you familiar with footnote 30 in the CCA's opinion?
Yes, Your Honor.
Even if we agree with you completely on everything else, how do we find prejudice in light of footnote 30?
Your Honor, I believe that appellant has a right to the process. And in this case, because the triggering mechanism should have been met, the appellant should receive the correct process by the CCA.
Would we not take their word for it that even if they had done the whole process, the outcome would have been the same?
Putting it below the line, I don't believe the process was sufficiently met because their triggering mechanism was not hit.
I don't quite understand your position. It seems as if in footnote 30, the CCA is saying to us, if the factual sufficiency review authority is triggered, had been triggered, quote, we would not be clearly convinced that the verdict is against the weight of the evidence. If we were to remand this, why wouldn't the CCA come back and politely say to us, CAF, we already told you how we would have resolved this case?
They very well may, Your Honor, but if they're reviewing the case incorrectly for the factual sufficiency, I don't know if we can be assured that they're also performing Part 2 and 3 of the statute correctly as well.
Further questions from the bench?
May I ask one question?
Absolutely.
Some of the CCAs have taken the position that they say, we assume without deciding that the trigger is met, or we're not sure whether the trigger is met, but in any event, we've conducted the analysis and we find it to be factually sufficient. Is that an acceptable means of proceeding?
After this case, Your Honor, probably not. Up until then, I believe they're probably waiting for this court to decide what the triggering mechanism means and whether the test that should be applied.
Any further questions? Seeing none, you may briefly conclude if you wish. Thank you, Captain Norton. Commander Cole.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson and members of the court. May it please the court. My name is Commander John Cole, and along with Mr. Brian Keller, I represent the United States. This court should affirm the lower court's opinion because appellant, while raising factual sufficiency review at the CCA, did not make a specific showing of a deficiency of proof as required.
The sound has been wonky the last 2 days. I just need you to speak up just a little bit more. Thank you.
The appellant has not made a specific showing of a deficiency of proof. As amended, Article 66 now states that courts of criminal appeals may consider whether the finding is correct in fact upon, one, the request of the accused, and two, if the accused makes a specific showing of a deficiency of proof. You can contrast this with the pre-amended Article 66, which, my colleague mentioned, require factual sufficiency review in every case. So when you look at the legislative history of this change, the point was to make the military courts function more like the civilian courts, where they're not conducting factual sufficiency in every single case.
Commander Cole, simply because it's top of mind based on the question posed by Judge Hardy, I'd like to better understand the government's position on footnote 30 in the CCA opinion. In your brief on page 22, you say that if, in fact, we conclude that the CCA's factual sufficiency review authority had been triggered, we need to remand. What is your view of footnote 30 in the CCA opinion, where it says if it had been triggered, we would not be clearly convinced that the verdict is against the weight of the evidence?
So, Your Honor, this court could remand, but given what the lower court lays out in footnote 30, it could be no prejudice, because based on that footnote, they would find, even conducting an analysis, that it was factually sufficient.
So it's the government's position that this was, in essence, an alternative holding?
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, can you tell me in your own words what the government believes the minimum that an appellant has to do to trigger factual sufficiency review?
Yes, Your Honor. The government agrees with how the lower court has interpreted it, and the lower court says the appellant must identify a weakness in the evidence admitted at trial, so actually point to some weakness in the evidence, and explain why, on balance, the evidence, or lack thereof, contradicts a guilty finding.
And why wasn't that satisfied here? Like, I look at the brief, and they said his conduct wasn't disrespectful, and they cited some case law, and they said there's case law that says this type of conduct is not disrespectful, and his conduct was a lot like that conduct, and they think there's an issue, right, a colorable issue as to whether his conduct was disrespectful. So why, it sounds to me like he pointed to an element, this disrespectful nature of his conduct, and he said, here's some case law, I don't think we satisfied that element. Why isn't that enough?
For several reasons, Your Honor. So the first part is, appellant does point to an element and cite some case law. That's in Part A. It's Joint Appendix 28 through 29. And appellant cites United States v. Felton, which is an Army case where the government had charged disrespect with language. And in that case, the lower court had looked at it and said, this is legally insufficient. It was a legal insufficiency case. In Part B, appellant asked the lower court to essentially disregard subjective testimony about whether appellant was disrespectful, and then goes on to point out several things, like that the evidence didn't show whether or not appellant had interrupted, whereas when you look at the actual record, there was evidence of interruption.
So, I mean, it's taking a while to explain why, I think, in the government's view, like, it wasn't a colorable argument. But if it takes that long to explain why it wasn't colorable argument, wasn't it a colorable argument? I mean, it wasn't frivolous, right? It wasn't, so you didn't say, this element wasn't satisfied because I'm a sovereign citizen and you have no jurisdiction over me, or something ridiculous, right? They had legal reasoning. They had the cases kind of on point. If you didn't know anything about this, I don't think you could dismiss it out of hand. So I guess what threshold, it sounds like you're saying, well, the CCA looked at it and they did some analysis and they thought about it and they decided that he wasn't right. But I think what the appellant's saying is, like, that's factual sufficiency review, right? Except they're calling it the trigger. So I guess my question is, where is, in the government's view, where is, like, what is enough? Like, at what point does the because that they offered when they were trying to satisfy the trigger, at what point is it satisfied? And at this point, we're just doing the factual sufficiency review, as opposed to deciding that they failed to trigger the review in the first place.
So, Your Honor, we have – it has to be pointing to some piece of evidence and showing how it undermines an element of a guilty finding. Lower courts have looked at this in different circumstances. One case where the lower court did find that the specific showing was met was United States v. Harvey, which this court considered and remanded on other grounds. But in that case, the lower court pointed out specific things that made a specific showing. They pointed out that the victim's testimony was contradicted in evidence by surveillance footage in the gym. But
counsel, this goes back to what Judge Hardy is asking. The difference between a showing of a deficiency versus proof of a deficiency. And as appellant is arguing, that when you start getting into the proof of the deficiency and weighing that proof, that is the factual sufficiency analysis. That's beyond a trigger. So, again, as Judge Hardy says, where do you draw the line then? Because you've at this point segued into the analysis of and weighing of a witness's testimony at the trial level.
Your Honor, I don't think looking at the landscape of the evidence to determine whether showing has been made is the same as getting into factual sufficiency necessarily. So once the court gets into factual sufficiency, they're weighing the different evidence against each other, giving it the weight they think it deserves. So, for example, as I was mentioning in Harvey, one of the things that the lower court found met a showing was there was surveillance footage that directly contradicted the victim's testimony. And so the court said that's a specific showing, and then moving on from that, then they get into the rest of the analysis, weighing the evidence against each other to see whether or not it actually is factually sufficient.
Okay. So as a follow-on, because the NMCCA created this three-prong analysis. Has the government, other than the lower court opinion, is there any other case law that supports, you know, this creation of this three-prong analysis to define what is a showing of deficiency?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor, but this CCA's test is essentially derived from just a plain reading of the words in the statute, and so all the words have to mean something, and so specific means designating a particular defined thing, so it has to be, they have to point to a thing. A showing is an instance of establishing through evidence and argument, and a deficiency is a lack, shortage, or insufficiency. So in order to meet this initial test, appellants have to do those three things. They have to point to something specific and show with evidence and proof how it's deficient.
Counsel, appellant's position is it's not enough to just say, I want a factual sufficiency review. Appellant says, I want a factual sufficiency review of this specific element or these specific elements of this particular offense because the evidence wasn't sufficient. And appellant's position is, they can't make a frivolous argument because they're going to have to back it up in the next section with an argument for why it is factually sufficient. I mean, the trigger is only going to get you the trigger. They still have to win on factual sufficiency review, and they're going to have to make an argument there at that point. And I think appellant's argument also is, from 1950, for 70 years, the CCAs had to look at every single element in every single for every single offense for which there was a finding of guilty to see if it was factually sufficient. This is a major change, even if you adopt their most extreme position, which is all you have to do is say, I want a factual sufficiency review of this particular element. That alone is a major change, and that the trigger should be trivial. The trigger should be simple to satisfy because, of course, it's only a trigger, and then you have to get to the analysis afterwards. What's your response to that?
Yes, Your Honor. The United States agrees it would be a change, even if it's simply appellants pointing out what element that they want factual sufficiency review. I would note that it won't always be appellate defense counsel, as mentioned during my colleague's argument, there will be appellants raising this on their own. And when you look at the legislative history of intending to put some kind of burden on appellants to raise this and make a specific showing, the United States position is it has to be more than simply saying it or raising it. The statute says must make a specific showing of a deficiency of proof, and those words mean something.
Can you go back to your answer to Judge Hardy's question? He asked, what would be the minimum that would have to be shown? I mean, so, for example, the issue is whether something is disrespectful. I want you to review that particular element because the evidence here shows that it wasn't the most polite conversation, but it wasn't disrespectful. Would that be enough?
No, Your Honor. It couldn't just be a general claim about insufficiency of the evidence. The appellant would have to point to specific things in the evidence. You know, witness A testified to this. Witness B testified to this. Or if there's a conflict in the evidence, there's this discrepancy between these two witnesses, and if you believed.
But doesn't the CCA have the power to look at the witness testimony and just disbelieve it, you know, and just or look at the situation and just draw a different conclusion? I mean, that it would seem that you're preventing the CCA from doing what they have the power to do during the second step by this trigger. That the trigger seems to be more than the analysis requires.
No, I disagree, Your Honor. I don't believe it is more. It's just there has to be something there to trigger it. And then once it's triggered, the CCA can do all this other analysis, like weighing and weighing credibility and all these things. But, you know, for example, in as I mentioned in the lower court's opinion in Harvey, they specifically noted the victim testified to this, and there was this other piece of evidence contradicting it. And so that was a specific showing that moved on to how do we weigh those things. And
I was going to say, it's not always the case that there's contradictory evidence. I mean, sometimes it's just there's only one witness who testifies, and that witness just is vague, doesn't seem to have a good grasp, doesn't present a clear picture. Would that be enough?
It could be, depending on the case, Your Honor. If there's one witness that testified and the appellant went through that testimony and pointed to facts that came out of that testimony and explained why it would undermine an element and a guilty finding, then yes, that could be enough.
But counsel, in your briefs, you argue that challenging the credibility of the witnesses and challenging the evidence in relation to that testimony is not sufficient. So I guess I'm not. I'm with my brethren on the bench at this point of, well, where is the scale? How do we define what the scale is? If it's something more than requesting it for the trigger, requesting it, identifying the element that is being challenged, and then essentially making a proffer, if it's more than that, I would submit again we're getting into what's the analysis. We're into the weighing of witness testimony, which, as you said, we've, in Harvey and other cases, the lower courts to grant deference to the trial court for having seen and heard the witnesses. So, yeah, how do we draw this line? I think that's what we're all struggling with. What is the government's position of how we're to draw this line on when the trigger for sufficiency, a showing of deficiency, is met?
Your Honor, the government's position would be that appellants have to specifically point to something in the evidence that, if what they're saying is true, could undermine a guilty finding. So,
but as Judge Maggs just said, what if there's an omission, that there's something that's part of the element that was not proved up? So you can't. There's no. I point to page record of trial page 283, where they didn't prove that I did X, Y, and Z.
Yes, Your Honor. I think the appellant could argue a lack of evidence and just point to the record and say in nowhere in this record is whatever the deficiency is.
Let me ask you another question. What should our standard of review be? So a CCA says the trigger was met, or the CCA says the trigger was not met, and a case comes up to us. What should our standard review be? Is that a de novo review that we look at, or is it an abuse of discretion? If the CCA isn't weighing any evidence, it's just looking if something is there, then why wouldn't it be de novo? On the other hand, if there is a weighing, wouldn't that be abuse of discretion?
Yes, Your Honor, this is not something we briefed specifically. Just off the top of my head, I would think it would be similar to something like an Article 62 where you have the government, you know, making an assertion that it's proof of substantial proof of a material fact, and I believe that this Court could review that de novo. It would be similar to something like that. So the government's position in this case is even under a minimal standard, not the minimal standard of an appellant just has to point out an element, but anything beyond that, the appellant just hasn't met it in this case. As I was mentioning, the testimony said was uncontroverted that the appellant interrupted. He was being given a counseling. It was the evidence was uncontroverted that he didn't refer to by his rank. And in contrast to what the appellant argues, the evidence before the CCA was not simply that the witnesses had subjective opinions about whether or not something was disrespectful. In testimony, she said, you know, talking about respect in general, if you're speaking to somebody, you wait until they finish what they're saying. If you have a rebuttal, you say it tactfully. You call somebody by their rank. And appellant did none of these things. And so the appellant has failed, even under a minimal standard, to raise a specific showing of a deficiency of proof. And absent any more questions from the Court, the United States asks that this Court affirm the lower court's opinion.
Thank you, Commander Cole.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Captain Norton.
Your Honor, what is enough? Your Honor, what is the scale? That creates a moving target for what is the triggering mechanism. The problem is it shouldn't be more than just a ticket to entry, because barriers will prevent appellants from raising factual sufficiency review for cases where there is an objective standard, such as disrespect. The allegation is that the evidence did not support the objective standard that under the circumstances Lance Corporal Valencia was disrespectful. Take this another example, if this is bodily harm, which is another objective standard. Under the government's theory, it might not even receive factual sufficiency review because the triggering mechanism may never be hit. And that's not workable. That would create a moving target, which would result in inefficiency in the system. The triggering mechanism should be simple. It should be able to raise the assignment of error and then specify the element that was not met beyond a reasonable doubt, and at most just have to have an analysis or discussion section that follows. After that, the triggering mechanism is hit. The government talked a lot about the facts. The facts is analysis. The facts is part two. Additionally, the government referred to the analysis that was conducted for triggering in United States v. Harvey. In that case, the government conceded the triggering mechanism was hit. And that's why this court didn't rule on what the triggering mechanism wanted in United States versus Harvey. So it should not be up to the government whether a triggering mechanism is hit. Counsel, and regarding footnote,
Before your time runs, I want to ask you the same question Judge Maggs asked the government: does the appellant have a view on what the standard of review? So if there is a conflict or a challenge to whether the CCA decides the trigger wasn't met,
it comes up here. What standard of review do we apply to that decision by the CCA?
De novo, Your Honor, because this should be a very simple process where I'd hope that not many courts are deciding under the circumstances of the case that it needs review. And finally, regarding footnote 30, in cases like United States v. Spencer, where this court ruled that the process for a sentence appropriateness and sentence disparity case was not followed properly by the lower court. The appellant would ask that the court would rule similarly, where it would clarify the standard that the lower courts need to apply, and then for the lower court to apply that standard. And hearing no further questions, appellant respectfully asks this court to reverse the NMCCA's decision and remand the case for factual sufficiency analysis under Parts 2 and 3 of Article 66, D1, Bravo. Thank you.
The case is now submitted. Court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand in recess until 10:25.
Court stands in recess until 10:25.